Before I start, did any of you want to ask any questions about or report a little bit about how it's been to practice the meditation? Yes.
You said last week that we could perhaps pay attention to whatever sensation appears to be most compelling. And I found as I was doing that that every few seconds there was a new one.
Yes.
And so I find myself kind of shifting around. I was wondering if that was what you had in mind.
It could be what I have in mind. At some point, we give some preference to the breathing. So it's not just completely random, whatever sensations. So we try to actually stay with the breath somewhat carefully. And only when we feel something else really compelling and really wants to pull us away, then we go to that sensation. It's possible to sit just open, completely open, and let whatever sensation arises be the place you put your attention. And then you have much more of a random feeling, kind of wandering around from one to the other. But because of the emphasis, the preference we give to the breathing, there's a little bit more stability, a little bit more focus. So it's only something which is really strongly compelling which pulls us away. When there's a tension between the breath and something else, that's when we go to something else. But there's no tension, you don't have to kind of go to everything. Does that make sense? Now, it does happen sometimes during the practice that a lot of things will happen very fast that are compelling. And then the instructions just give up control. You know, don't try to control things, just go along with it. Go for the ride, just follow along everything. Yes?
I have the strong sensation that I continue watching my breath, but look around. And then at times I focus on a particular thing, but I find it difficult not to kind of be aware of the rest, to focus on the breath.
Uh-huh.
I still kind of know what's going on.
Right. Oh, so so I don't know if this responds to you, but one of the things I find very useful in this understanding this practice is this, to distinguish between foreground and background of attention. What we do is we place the breath in the foreground of attention. And there's a lot of things you'd be aware of in the background of your attention. And as long as things stay in the background, we just leave them in the background. So if there's bodily sensations or thoughts or feelings or emotions or sounds, if they're in the background, you kind of know they're there, some of them. But if it's easy to keep the breath in the foreground, just continue to focus on the foreground. When something from the background pushes itself into the foreground, that's when we let go of the breath. But as long as it stays in the background, just leave it there. Now, it's also possible to have kind of split attention. It's possible for the attention on the breathing to become mechanical or become kind of rote. And that's something we want to keep careful guard over, so that there's a kind of aliveness to the attention that's present for the breathing. So if what you're reporting is just there's a background attention is operating and things are in the background, that's fine. But if your attention is split and you have kind of like two foregrounds, or you're kind of being with the breath, but really you're involved in some kind of fantasy or something, that part of your mind, that intention, that capacity of mind to be onto something else besides the breath while you're being with the breath, bring that around like a wonderful Aikido master. Bring that around gently. And take that force and that energy, that weight of that opponent, in a sense, and bring it to bear back on the breath, so that all your foreground attention, all your foreground intention, is gently channeled to the breath. What else? Yes. Doubt. Well, you're not supposed to have doubt. Well, today is a good day for doubt. Because I'm going to talk about emotions. And doubt, emotions, mental states, doubt is one of them. Doubt is a difficult one because it usually involves a belief. And then we tend to kind of believe the belief. Oh, I'm not good enough, or I can't accomplish this, or this is not the right thing for me, or whatever. Doubt, when it becomes a hindrance, there can be healthy doubt. But doubt, when it becomes a hindrance, often takes the form of a kind of physical resistance or unwillingness. And one of the things we'll talk about today is when we have a mental state which has become predominant, one of the most powerful ways to connect to it fully and be with it fully, allow it to be there fully, is to feel it in the body. So with doubt, you can feel sometimes the unwillingness, the resistance, and feel that in the body and hang out with it as a body meditation. Feel the tightness or the contraction or the pulling away or whatever until it passes. But you don't have to believe your thoughts always. So that's just a kind of short little thing to say about it. There's much more that can be said. Well, I thought today I would start with telling my football story. A time when I was watching football. Some years ago, I was watching football with two other Vipassana teachers on television. And I don't watch television that much or football on television much. But we were watching together. And my friend had the remote control in his hand, so he was in control. And as all sensible people do, when the commercials came on, he hit the mute button. And most sensible people, I thought, when the football game starts again, you hit the mute button again so you can hear the sound. But my friend didn't do that. And, you know, he was a mindfulness teacher, and I'm a mindfulness teacher, and I thought, well, this is interesting. Instead of kind of, you know, jabbing him in the ribs and saying, hey, I said, let's just pay attention here. Instead of doing something, let's just pay attention. This is interesting. Let's bring my attention to this and notice what's going on. So I thought, this is interesting. So I started watching the football game without any sound. And after a while, he hit the mute button and the sound came on. And I was struck by the big difference between watching football with the sound and without the sound. And the main difference was that without the sound, what was lacking was the voice of the commentator. And the commentator's job, as far as I can tell, is more than just tell you what's going on in the game, but to infuse the whole event with some emotional involvement, get you excited. Because I could watch, you know, without the sound, I kind of basically knew what was going on. These guys were standing, falling. You know, and every once in a while, one of them would have the ball, and you'd see him going down to the 40-yard line, 30-yard line. Look, oh, this looks pretty good. Looks like he might make it. Oh, no, someone grabbed him. You know. But that was pretty good. He probably has a first down. You know, great. You know, he's kind of watch calmly. When the sound was on and the commentator was speaking, oh, my God, he made it to the 40-yard line, the 30. And I'm on the edge of my seat. I'm not standing. You know, all excited. There's a huge difference between the experience of watching a game with a commentator and without, at least for me. The commentator is not the game. The commentator is not needed. Actually, one person I know about, he doesn't like the commentators on the television, so he turns the sound off on the television and puts the radio on, and he likes the radio commentators better. So the commentators is optional, you know, what's added to the situation. However, many of us, when we watch these games, we don't necessarily distinguish the experience of the football game as it is really on the field, and our experience of watching a football game and listening to the commentator. The commentator and the football game are kind of, in our kind of direct experience, all happen together. And we don't see how they're separate. It's very much the same way in our own life, in our own mind. We have this constant commentary that's going on in our own head. And the commentary about our life, about this and that, about the future, about the past, what happened yesterday, what happened when we were a child, all stuff, it still belongs to the realm of commentary. It's not about what's really going on in the present moment. But we are fooled maybe in the same way we often fool when we watch television. And our experience of our life is intertwined with our comments about it. But it's not necessarily the case that our comments and our direct experience of being alive have to be so intertwined. It's possible to have a very alive, full experience, be in direct contact with life, direct contact with other people, and not be enmeshed in the commentaries about that experience, what's going on. This distinction between the commentary, the words and ideas we describe our experience and our direct experience, is a very important one for mindfulness practice. And what we're trying to do in mindfulness practice is not to reject anything. We're not rejecting our thoughts, at least not until next week when I talk about that instruction. What we're trying to do is simply to see the difference between the two, so we don't have to be fooled by it, and so we don't have to live our life in the commentary. Because life is much richer when we're not lost in the commentary. And so what happens in meditation, we can begin seeing a little bit the difference between our direct experience and the commentary. You sit here and you're following your breath, and your breath is what it is. But we're following your breath, and you're breathing kind of shallowly up in your chest. And then this comment comes in, right, that says, uh-oh, in California, you're supposed to have long and deep breaths down in your belly. Especially, you know, in humanistic California. And so suddenly there's a commentary that you're not doing it right. And then, oh, my God, I'm not doing it right. I never do anything right. How can I find myself doing one more thing wrong? I hope no one's noticing. You know, it's a good thing we keep practicing with our eyes closed. Is a teacher keeping his eyes closed? And pretty soon you're lost in this, you know, commentary about the commentary about the commentary, and it has no longer anything to do with the breath, right? So that's one of these insidious things about this commentary. It's bad enough to make commentary about what's really going on, but then we kind of add these generations of comments on the comments. And it's even amazing is that many of us, when we talk to each other, it's our 32nd generation comment which is talking to his 64th generation comment. And it's not really about what's going on in the present moment. So what we do in mindfulness practice is we notice, I'm making a comment about my breathing. That's not the breath. I think I'll go back and just be with the breath I have. It happens to be shallow and tight. I'm just going to experience it for what it is and forget about the commentary. You have a knee pain. It's a wonderful place to see the difference between commentary and the direct experience. You have a wonderful feeling of relaxation and joy that bubbles up inside of you as you meditate. Pay careful attention when you get caught in the commentary and when you're there just for the joy. The commentary says, oh my God, I've arrived, this is it. I'm the world's best meditator. Or whatever, right? I hope the teacher is looking now. So what we're trying to do is just simply allow things to be there as they are in their own right, as they are in their own existence. It's a kind of generous act, actually. It's a generous act to allow things to be there as they are without getting caught up in the commentary and then living in the commentary rather than living in direct experience. So that's all introduction to our first sitting. So let's sit together. And if you'd like just to stand for 10 seconds, you can. One of the great lessons to be learned from doing a mindfulness practice is that there's, in any situation you find yourself in, there's at least one thing you can always do, and that is bring attention to bear on the situation. And we just pay attention to what's directly happening. So close your eyes, and just directly, without any commentary, what is your experience of yourself right now? to notice your own experience as it's happening is to begin to wake up. And it's as simple as to notice what's happening right now. So take a comfortable but alert posture. Let your spine be alive and alert. And then around that alert spine, let your rest of your torso and your shoulders relax. It's sometimes nice to take a couple of deep breaths at the beginning, connecting to the body as you breathe in. And as you breathe out, relaxing, letting go. Letting go of your commentary. And then letting your breath breathe itself, breathing normally. You might also go through your body and relax some of the muscles that are easy to relax. Sometimes it's possible to relax the forehead, the eyes, the jaw, as you breathe out, relaxing the shoulders, as you breathe out, relaxing the chest and the stomach. And then take a couple of moments to really feel your breathing intimately. Be like a discoverer, an explorer of the breath. What is the body's experience of breathing before you make commentary about it? Letting the breath arise within the breath. When the mind wanders away in thought, in commentary, gently let go of it and awaken again to your breathing. Notice when the mind gets caught in the commentary and comments and thoughts. And rather than living in the commentary, live in your body. Let your attention rest in the bodily experience of breathing. The experience of the body moving, the warmth and the coolness, the pressure and the relaxation, letting go of the out-breath. If the sound of the rain is predominant for you, do listening meditation, listening to the rain, noticing the difference between listening to the sounds and your ideas and thoughts and commentary. If that arises, let go of the commentary and listen. And when the sound is no longer strong or has passed away or no longer compelling, then gently come back again to the breath. When any other strong sensations arise into the foreground, you can let go of the breath, let the breath recede to the background, and take the new sensation as your meditation, allowing it to be as it is, feeling it directly, noticing at least the difference between commentary and the sensation. If you don't see the difference, it's a lot easier to get caught up in the commentary. If you see the difference, it's a lot easier then to rest with what's directly happening. And now, let go of your breathing. And take a few moments to discern, to discover. What is the mood or emotional state, mental state, that happens to be most predominant in your experience now? It could be anything at all, any emotional state or mental state. What is present for you? Are you restless or calm? Are you angry or happy? Are you tense? Sad? At ease? And then allowing that emotional state to be there, however subtle it might be. Notice what sensations, physical sensations in the body, correspond to that state of being, that emotional state. Are there any sensations in your body that inform you that this emotional state is present, this mood is present? And then allow yourself to be present for those sensations, noticing what happens to them as you allow them to be there generously. And then come back again to your breathing for another couple of minutes, last 2 minutes of the sitting. And let whatever fullness of being you can gather together, let it rest there on the comings and goings of the breathing for 2 minutes. So again, to repeat again, one of the remarkable abilities, very mundane abilities we have, but is this ability to, in any situation we find ourselves in, one of the options that we can, options of ways of responding to a situation, is to simply bring attention to it. It doesn't mean acting on a situation or responding to it or running away from it or doing a thing. Simply bringing attention is a very powerful thing, and it kind of lubricates so much of life when the attention fills our life more and more. So rather than jumping into an argument quickly, or rather than acting on impatience, or rather than defending oneself as soon as you're attacked, or just have some moments there where you're paying attention. What's actually going on here? Can be very, very powerful. What we're trying to do in mindfulness practice is allow this ability to pay attention to shine and be something which is, in a sense, all-pervading, in a kind of one way maybe to describe it, or be panoramic, 360 degrees or whatever. The ability in Buddhism, awareness itself is considered to be kind of a sacred reality. And what makes awareness sacred is when awareness has nothing outside, when nothing's excluded from awareness, when everything is allowed to be included within the field of awareness. Most of us will exclude things from awareness. So I don't want that. No way. Or I want this, and instead of that. And there's a constant selection process. Resistance and desire is very, very powerful. And we see it, you go into a room, and some people come into the room and kind of scan the room just to kind of get a quick sense of who they're going to sit next to and who they're not going to sit next to, close to. And there's already a selection process that's going on. I don't know if that was the best example, but when awareness leaves nothing outside, that's when awareness becomes sacred. And one of the places, there's many places in our own personal experience that many of us leave outside. Some people, it's their physical experience of their body. I think Jung or Freud, whoever it was, had it wrong when he said that the dreams are the royal road to the unconscious. It might be one road. It's probably like a back alley. I think the royal road to the unconscious is through the body. Our so-called unconscious motivations and feelings and ideas all get processed through the body, all occur in the body. The body is actually a much more direct link and more honest link than trying to do it through the symbolism of our dreams. So many people are shut off from their body. And there's good reason for it, because the body is is intimately connected to our emotional expression. When we repress an emotion, we repress that part of the body that's associated with the expression of that emotion. And so people then become numb. They don't want to pay attention to their body. They exclude that from the field of awareness. A lot of the process of mindfulness as a path involves a waking up of the body and becoming more fully embodied again. Letting the body kind of be free again to express itself, to feel itself fully. Other people, kind of related to this, other people exclude from awareness their emotions. Or certain emotions are excluded, but other emotions are included. And it isn't that they're not having those emotions, they're not including them in the field of awareness. My own situation hopefully was a good example. I had a self-image that I was not an angry person. I'm Norwegian, so anger wasn't supposed to kind of be part of the scene. Now, if you have that kind of image of yourself, there tends to be a bias not to notice your anger. And that was actually the case in my early 20s, that I would have anger and I wouldn't even know I was angry. I didn't have a clue I was angry, because it didn't fit into the kind of way in which I'd kind of sculpted my awareness to what could be included and what should be excluded. So many of us do that also. Some people, it's their cognitive abilities which are outside of the field of awareness, their thoughts. And I think most of us, to some degree, a lot of our thoughts are kind of an automatic pilot, and we hardly even know what we're thinking, and we're getting in trouble. It's very powerful to bring awareness to our thinking process also, to really be cognizant about what we're really thinking. The point of mindfulness is not to become more, particularly more mindful of the body, or more mindful of the emotions, or more mindful of our cognitive experiences, but rather the point of mindfulness is to free up the awareness fully so that we can meet all of life without excluding anything from it. It doesn't mean condoning things. It doesn't mean giving in to things. It means at least in the field of awareness, everything's included. And this is actually a very subtle, and maybe not so subtle, very important point that's confusing for people. People will think, oh, if I'm doing mindfulness practice, I'm supposed to be kind of a pushover, allow whatever's happening to happen. We keep talking about allowing in mindfulness practice, allow things to be. What we're really talking about is allowing anything that arises, whether it's good or bad, evil or beauty, or painful or pleasant, allowing it to exist in awareness without any contraction of awareness, without any exclusion in awareness, without any barriers in the awareness. You can still decide to do, you said, well, I'm going to say no to this thing. I don't have to live up to this, or I don't have to agree to this. You can decide all kinds of things. But deciding how to respond to the situation doesn't require you to contract the awareness. So it's really because it's a beautiful thing when awareness itself has this freedom that can flow out evenly to whatever arises within it. And that in Buddhism is called, if you're interested in the religious side of all this, this is in Buddhism is considered one of the sacred realms. The greatest sacredness is when awareness leaves nothing outside. So this is a kind of also an introduction to this practice. The practice itself is to learn how to bring this kind of awareness to all aspects of our life. So we've talked about the body last week, and kind of beginning to waken that up, and there's a lot more that can be said. Tonight we're going to talk about the emotions. It's an area where a lot of people have trouble bringing attention to, and so it's kind of the next thing to talk about. What did some of you notice? In the end of this last sitting, I asked you to check in and notice what your emotions or mental state might be like. What was that like to spend a few moments checking in and noticing it? And yes?
Instead of just having my emotions, I was judging what I should be feeling.
Which is the commentary.
Yeah, it was like, well, this came up, you know, this happened, so you should be feeling this way. Instead of, and I kept catching myself, but then I'd go right back to that again.
It is very powerful habits. Isn't it that you need to necessarily stop judging? Because that's to say, oh, I shouldn't be judging, is that it can be a putting up of a wall in your awareness again. What we're trying to do is, rather than putting up a wall, say, oh, let me notice the judgment. Oh, judging. What's judging like? Oh, that's interesting. Another alternative would be to add another judgment on top of the judgment, another commentary on top of the judgment. So you're sitting there, you're feeling some emotion. Oh, there's a judgment. Shit, I'm not supposed to be doing this. I'm doing it wrong. That's another judgment. What we do in mindfulness is not to, we try our best not to add anything to it, but we accept what has arisen. We accept the judgment if that's arisen. And then if that's predominant, it's to go in and bring attention to it. And attention itself is never judgmental. It's the beauty of attention. It doesn't judge. It just sees what's there. But yeah, that's what happens. So we noticed that also. Thank you. Do you have a sense that you're a little bit freer if you see the difference between the two? What else? Yes.
Oh. So if I realized that I had absolutely no idea what I was feeling, and I wasn't too surprised to find that I was a bit detached from that, is the sense of like being far away from my emotions and just having no idea what I'm feeling, is that an illusion? And in the sense that my first report would be I don't have any idea. Is that in some way an emotional state itself, or is it just that I'm this far away and I just have to continue?
Well, there's always an emotional state present.
Okay.
In every mind moment. And it could be a number of things. It could be that it's so subtle you can't notice, which is possible. What's more common for many people who kind of are fresh to meditation, this kind of paying attention, is that because of various reasons, they're out of touch with their emotions. And often, many people are out of touch with their emotions for good reason, because their emotions have been painful. There's a lot of pain there. A lot of feelings can be, painful feelings can be held back, can be held away. And people would rather not pay attention to their emotions because that's to open a floodgate of grief or of sadness or of anger or rage. I'm not saying that's your situation, but that's one of the options it might be. And so some people who are very much out of touch with their emotions, it's because of some deep pain usually. And as they do mindfulness practice, it's to open to that pain. And the beautiful thing is when we open to our awareness to feel the pain, our emotional pain, that same opening allows us to feel emotional beauty. The degree in which we become numb to our grief and our sadness and our rage and our anger, to some degree, we also then become numb to our ability to feel joy and happiness and friendship. So as we open to the pain, we actually open to greater things, wider things. Sometimes it's confusion that might keep people at a distance from their emotions. They're having it, and it's not that they're really repressing it, but they're just kind of lost in the confusion of commentary. They don't know what's going on. And so then maybe confusion itself is kind of a mental state. And so maybe you would go in and notice the confusion. What's a confused state of mind feel like? Oh, it feels like, marbles racing around inside my head. So does that speak a little bit to you, or?
I was wondering if detachment itself, before you open to levels, if there's emotion before that.
Probably, but there's always an emotion. There's always a mental state or an emotional state, and detachment is a dangerous state to be in because it's keeping things at a distance. In Buddhism, what we say is, the goal, in a sense, is not to be detached, which is dangerous, but rather to be unattached. And the difference, it's maybe semantics, but the difference is detached is to hold things at a distance. Unattached is to be in touch with them, but not sticking to them. Yes?
I felt very agitated for a while. And so I thought, well, I'll just pay attention to this and see where I actually feel it in my body. And I felt it like in my chest, all the way from my navel up. And the more I noticed it, the more my heart beat faster. And then after a while, I was thinking, when is this going to be over? You know? Because I began to feel like how you would feel when you were getting really scared. And it seemed to sort of come to a crescendo, and then
there are three things that can happen when you watch something.
There was that little moment there where I could tell that I was kind of getting caught by it,
Were you getting caught by it or by your concerns about it?
Probably my concerns about it, because it was feeling too much like being afraid.
So if you can notice the difference between the commentary and the direct experience, and then you'll be freer next time. Maybe one more report, how it was. Yeah.
When you asked us to focus our attention on our emotions, and so I did that, and I could really feel my emotions deeply. And then I started trying to put a name on what I was feeling. And I couldn't come up with a good name. And then you started suggesting a name, and I was listening to what you were saying, and I'm like, yeah, that's it. And then I listened and said, No, so this whole process kicked into me. And I was like, gosh, I can't come up with a name for it. Why? I've got to come up with a name for this. And I said, why am I doing that?
I'll talk a little bit about that. One of the ways in which we do mindfulness practice is label the experience. We name the experience. It's very powerful with emotions. But you don't have to... But it should not be an analytical effort. If it's not obvious what it is, if you're not obvious that you're happy or sad or whatever, don't spend a lot of time trying to find the right name. Maybe you just say, oh, I'm having, you name it, an emotion. The name isn't as important as to feel it fully. So what you're trying to do is feel it fully. And the naming supports the feeling of it, bringing attention to it. I'll talk about that in a little bit, just in a few moments. So emotions, our emotional life is a very important part of our life. And in mindfulness practice, or in Buddhist practice, we just include that as matter-of-factly as part of everything we pay attention to. It isn't like we validate emotions more, you know, particularly. It isn't that we invalidate them particularly. It isn't that we emphasize them or de-emphasize them. We just take them to be part of the manifestation of the present moment. And we're, because they're there, we're going to pay attention to it. And attention, again, is very powerful, because attention is a third alternative. The alternative most people are very familiar with, especially in popular psychology culture, is repression and expression, or repression and catharsis. You have to, if you have an emotion, you have to repress it. That was what we learned to do in the 50s. And then came along the 60s, and we learned to cathart. And you know, it's express all your feelings. It's very important to express it. But the third option is to do neither, but rather to bring attention to it, to attend to it, to discover what it is fully. And it's actually more powerful because you set it free. See, if you express it, if you are expressing it, doing something about it, acting out on it, it is not free. You're adding your involvement and all the complicated ideas of who you think you are and why you need to do it on top of it. And if, but rather, if you bring your attention to it in a very wonderful way, you set it free. The word emotion has the word motion in it. And the E of emotion means out. It's to move out. All emotions are in process, unless they're frozen. Attention unfreezes the emotions. The more careful the attention, what an emotion wants to do is emotion wants to flow. It wants to move, wants to be in flux. Emotions do not stay fixed unless you're constantly fixing them by some kind of involvement with them. When we bring attention, careful attention to it, it does a number of things. But one of the things it does, attention is different than the commentary. Attention is different than the judgment and ideas we have of it. It's often the commentary, the ideas, the evaluations we have that often fuel and add things extra on top of the beauty of a particular emotion. So when we bring attention to it, we bring something different than how we fuel it, or how we hold on to it, or how we judge it. And when we bring attention to it in that way, it sets it free. And when emotion sets free, it processes itself. There's a wonderful way in which our life can process itself beautifully. We don't need to do 30 years of psychoanalysis to let our life process ourselves. We can do it in 5 minutes, sitting in the midst of it. It's very powerful. And we'll discover wonderful things about ourselves. But the point of mindfulness practice is not to discover wonderful things about ourselves. The point of mindfulness is just to be mindful, just to pay attention. This is what's going on. Oh, I'm having an emotion. Isn't this interesting? As opposed to, oh my God, I'm having an emotion. So we're fascinated rather than whatever other options you might have. So emotions are wonderful, and they have a full place, you know, in the palace of mindfulness. There are guests of honor at the banquet, as everything else is. But we don't put them at the head of the table either. So how do we bring attention to emotions? Some people find it very hard. So a number of things. And actually, I list them as kind of four steps. But they're not really four steps. Four aspects of the same thing. Helpful sometimes to divide it up. One of the most important things to do around emotions is to recognize you're having one. And that's sometimes 90% of the game. Sometimes it's very difficult, either because we repress it, like me with my anger, or because we're too busy, or because we're looking somewhere else or whatever, to really recognize that we're having some kind of emotional expression. When it's happening, not after the fact, is a very powerful thing. Just recognize, oh, there's an emotion. The second aspect is to accept it or to allow it. Again, it doesn't mean condoning it. It doesn't mean giving into it. It simply means allowing it to be there in awareness without any contraction, without any attempt to push it away or hold on to it. Just allow it to be there, giving it its freedom in the field of awareness. So this, I call that acceptance. The third thing that's very useful is to name it, to name the emotion. And as I said earlier, you don't have to kind of be looking for the right name. You can just use a generic name if you want. But sometimes it's very clear what it is. And sometimes you can very clearly, very obviously, you can distinguish resentment from anger. And then it's useful to say, oh, there's resentment. But if you can't distinguish it, then just say generically, oh, I'm angry, or whatever. But to name it, the naming is very powerful. Awareness itself disengages ourselves from identification with an emotion. Because awareness never identifies. Where we get so much in trouble with emotions is when we identify with them. So awareness itself begins the process of disidentification. Naming adds to that process. And it's like many of the fairy tales that, you know, from many cultures, many of the myths. If you name the dragon loses its power. Or in some cultures, if you tell someone your birth name, they get power over you. There's power in naming. And the power in the psychological aspect of naming is that it counters or it interrupts or it pauses for a moment the incessant tendency of us to be identifying, preoccupying, judging our emotions. By naming it, we step out of that game for a moment. And we step out of that game, a part of ourselves, even just a little piece of ourselves, steps out of the game of preoccupation, judgment, commentary. We create space around it, and it's easier to allow it to be. It loses some of its hold on us. The power that it loses is the power that comes from the way we identify with it. So naming is very, very useful. Yes? Yeah, you don't do that. Oh, yeah. So if you have that kind of tendency, you need to be. You probably have it anyway in your life. It isn't just happening fresh now. So start noticing that, and see if you can allow the naming to occur just simply without the added commentary on top of it. And as you begin to become more attentive and notice that pattern, that tendency, you'll start becoming freer of it until you can just put it to rest. Yes?
So by naming it, you're trying to detach from it?
Detached is a no-no word.
And is it similar to like when you're trying to clear your mind and you hear a noise and you just kind of say to yourself, oh, hearing?
Yeah. What we're trying to do is we're just trying to be honest with what's happening in the present moment. That's all it is. That's all mindfulness is. So when you're having an emotion, and the emotion is the compelling thing in the present moment, if the emotion comes into the foreground of attention, you want to be there and recognize it. And one of the ways to recognize it is to name it. You don't have to name it. Naming is not required in mindfulness practice, but it's proven to be very, very useful for most people who try it. Very quietly, especially with emotions. Because of our strong tendency to identify with it, get caught up in it. And does that answer your concern? No? Think about it and ask it again, your question. Yes?
I'm a little bit confused. I mean, certainly what you said about emotions in meditation would... I understand the point of recognizing your emotion. Certainly some people may have difficulty with that. But then there's some emotions which you would like to share with others, not necessarily keep for yourself. And of course it may not be possible during the meditation, but in the real life, if we are to sort of use this role in every life, we
keep them for ourselves, right?
Yes, very good. Very good point. The point of mindfulness practice is not to be a zombie. The point of mindfulness practice is not to interrupt the flow of our life, but rather to be awake in the middle of it. And again, that's why I tried before to distinguish between allowing things to exist fully, unattachedly, in awareness. Distinguishing that from either, you know, all the different ways in which we choose to act on a particular thought or an emotion. It's a beautiful thing to express your emotions to your friends, or it can be a deadly thing to do that. You know, it's all kinds of things to express emotions. And hopefully the beautiful ones is something you act on if it's appropriate in a situation. I don't want you to stop doing that, but I would like to see you being awake in the middle of it. Now, if you have a beautiful emotion and you identify with that emotion, then you add a kind of complication to the situation that is unnecessary. So, for example, if you're feeling a lot of happiness and you feel that, you know, and you've been depressed for 20 years and all your colleagues know you've been depressed for 20 years and finally feeling happy and you go around really full of pride and insisting that everybody see that you're how happy you are. Look, I'm happy! You're adding something extra to the situation. Just allow yourself to be happy. Am I making myself clear? Or am I responding to your concern?
Yeah, I still don't get what you mean by identifying your emotion.
Oh, it's a vague word. It means preoccupied with it. It means taking an emotion, for example, and not just allowing it to be there for itself, but relating it to how this our self-image is. So, for example, if I'm happy, it's really important to me that you all see me as a happy person. Or if I identify with my anger, for example, one way so-called identification is not to see it. I'm not an angry person. So we create a different kind of identity in relationship to our emotions. And this kind of involvement, relating our emotions to a sense of self, is one of the most insidious and painful things we do around emotions. So please, you know, your wholesome, beautiful emotions, express them with your friends without anything extra. Yeah.
Do you think that having commentary about it adds to, does that have to do with identification?
Not necessarily, but another word I like is preoccupation.
Yeah.
Because that's a beautiful word, because what we're trying to have is an unpreoccupied mind. A mind which is not fixated on something. And if we're preoccupied with our emotions, then we're not free with our emotions. You can still be occupied with your emotions. You can still have your emotions there, you can still have your thoughts there, and allow them to be occupy yourself. But there's some freedom in it. You're not preoccupied.
The reason I asked is I was thinking that sometimes when I get angry, I'm just going over it and over. I think, I know I'm angry. And I have a lot of commentary about it in my head.
Okay, those of you who are counting, I only said three of the four aspects. So the first three was recognizing that there's an emotion going on. The second is to accept it, to allow it to be there. The third is to name it. And the fourth aspect is to investigate it, to get to know it better. And that can mean a whole slew of things. I don't want to make it too complicated like this. But it means just to get to explore it. What is this? Kind of look a little bit closer at it. What is anger? What is happiness? One of the powerful ways to investigate an emotion is to feel it in the body. All emotions are expressed in the body some way or other. And you can find somewhere the emotional component part of it. It's part of the emotion. It isn't that the bodily expression is like bodily manifestation is the expression as if the emotion was different. They arise together. And so if you feel the emotion in your body as it exists in the body, that's a way of getting really close to the emotion, feeling it really carefully, And you're lot less likely to get preoccupied with the emotion if you feel it in your body than if you feel it kind of nebulously as a cognitive event. So we want to really feel our emotional life really carefully when it arises, when it's predominant. And one of the ways to explore it and investigate it is to feel it in your body. You're much less likely to identify with it or get a commentary about it if you feel it in your body. The body is always happening in the present moment. So it's a wonderful place to connect to your emotions. More profoundly, as we feel it in our body and allow the sensations to be there, they tend to open up. They tend to process themselves faster. So if you feel anger, and you feel anger as a tightness in your chest, for example, if instead of feeling that tightness, you're thinking, oh, my, that bastard, you know, why did he do that? You know, and I can't wait to talk to him, and why did I say that to him, and he said that to me, and then he said this to me, and oh boy, am I angry, am I ever angry, I've justified my anger. You know, that just fuels it on and on, right? It's going to be endless cycles, it can. In the meantime, your chest is really tight, and it gets tighter and tighter as your mind works itself up. If instead of spinning yourself out in your thoughts, you drop down into the chest, and feel the tightness in the chest. Allow it to be there. Just simply feel it. Don't try to get rid of it. Just allow it to be there. Whatever processing that emotion needs to happen, whatever processing that emotion needs to happen, will happen a lot easier if you get out of the cognitive way of it and allow just to feel it in the body and let that tightness do what it wants to do. Sometimes it gets tighter, sometimes it gets softer. And often as it changes, you'll start discovering fascinating things about your emotions. Some of the emotions are built on other emotions. Anger is a fascinating one. Anger often, if you investigate anger, not to analyze it, but just be in the present moment and discover what arises in the present moment as you're really present for anger, you'll probably notice that anger is arising out of probably one or two things: hurt or fear, or frustration. And if you can feel the hurt or the frustration or the fear, you're dealing much more with the deeper roots of the situation than if you're just dealing with the anger. And that's why catharting with anger is not so useful if there's deeper roots involved with the anger, that's a source of the anger. Because if you only cathart but express the anger and don't understand that fear is a source of the anger, the fear itself has never really become been processed fully and reliably and completely. And it's better to kind of go deeper into the roots of what's really happening. Does that all make sense? Or is it cycle devil? Yes?
You said the magic word, cycle devil.
I beat you to the punch.
What I've been thinking, as you've been talking about investigating, in reflecting on some of your implicit comments about Western psychotherapy, and maybe this is the fourth session of thought, but I think it's connected to emotion, that, and I don't have any particular bias one way or another toward Western psychotherapy, but I'm getting a sense that you're excluding the words. When I hear the word anger, I think with many people it has to do with family and a history of anger that goes way, way back. And I'm not quite sure how you fit that in with your investigative and exploration mode about emotions. Thich Nhat Hanh has taught quite a bit about Western psychotherapy in trying to, instead of saying it doesn't exist, or it's
not good. Yeah, I think your point is very well taken. I think you need to give me a little bit of leeway in a 5-week introductory course on mindfulness that I can't cover everything. It's really some really the basics I'm trying to offer here.
But I guess what I'm getting at is that
But part of part
I know a number of people who think that this is all silly because it doesn't address some of those basic issues of early childhood.
Sure.
And it seems like a false dichotomy.
I don't know if it's a false dichotomy. It's a possible distinction that can be made.
You mean what is silly?
Well, that mindfulness is dismissed out of hand by some people who are very find Western psychotherapy very useful because it does. They don't see a place of attachment.
One of the things that I think maybe this is a huge topic, and I'd rather not go into too much of it.
Sorry.
But one of the things that maybe I want to mention in response is that I don't think that mindfulness, the way I'm teaching you here, is the be-all and end-all of how to be a human being. There's a lot of things we need to learn and do. Just use our common sense, and it's not a substitute for careful reflection about and thinking about our life when that's appropriate to do, and reflecting about our life and thinking about it and thinking about our taxes and thinking about our family and our family history and our relationships is an important part of life. And anybody with a little bit of common sense will do it. So I'm not offering this as a substitute. What I'm doing is trying to offer one particular form of practice which is very powerful and can be very useful and actually can be supportive for these other endeavors. And hopefully, my trust is you'll know when it's appropriate to do mindfulness and when it's appropriate to do some other kind of practice, you know. To be patently absurd, I mean, mindfulness is not a substitute to brushing your teeth, right? There's all kinds of things. Yeah, sixth session. And the same thing as brushing your teeth, you know, that's obvious, right? But maybe what's less obvious is because psychology and social life is kind of closely akin to what I'm teaching, it sounds like it's one or the other. And I hope that's not the point. And then I'd respond to the psychologist to say that this is, you know, silly. To say that it's not silly, but it could be a very valuable support for what they're trying to do. Yes?
Well, I'd like to do a personal example. I think they're really companion pieces. That I had a really difficult relationship with my mother, and I was having a difficult relationship with someone at work, and I was paying better attention, and all of a sudden it seemed like a silly idea, but it hit me that this person wasn't my mother. I really felt it and understood it. And I think that in the moment was more helpful than just talking about what my mother was trying to do and getting over it. I think sometimes both practices can only enhance those things.
Thank you. And in the back.
I just wanted to clarify with you, because you've been talking about expressing warm, positive emotions and maybe not expressing anger. Are you really saying that you shouldn't express your anger, or are you saying you should be aware when you're angry and sort of think about it?
I'd rather not be the authority on that question.
But it seems
I'm just trying to teach you to pay attention.
And I was thinking about yesterday when I went to the bathroom for 30 seconds and my 4-year-old had drawn with red crayon all over my counters and the wall, that I felt that was the appropriate time to express anger.
What does that mean to express anger in that situation?
To a 4-year-old? You say, I'm very angry at you, and this is not something that you're supposed to be doing.
So you're not screaming on top of your head all red and at your 4-year-old and with a kitchen knife kind of waving about pounding the pillow next to him. I'm expressing my anger pounding your pillow.
I try not to.
I think there's a huge difference between acting out on something like pounding the pillows and expressing very honestly, this is what's going on with me, and say to someone, I am really angry, and your voice can be quivering while you say it. You know, you're repressing your anger. That's a lot different than punching them out. Mm-hmm. And so I want to distinguish between acting on something versus simply being honest about it and letting the natural process, the natural expression be there. There's a natural expression that's there. And then there's acting on it based on all kinds of social conditionings we have about how we need to be in a particular situation.
And when you're, I'm still sort of struggling a little bit with how you're using the word identification. When you're using the word identification in the example of anger, would that be more the sort of turning red in the face, kitchen knife thing, sort of just letting me take over your being? Is that?
Well, I don't have like, you know, good definition for these words, but for example, you can identify with the anger, and you can feel. Some people think that they're only really alive and really justified as human being if they feel the energy of anger. In some family dynamics, everybody's been angry at each other, and it's the only way they kind of have a sense of who they are is if they're angry. So if the only way you have a sense of being someone is by being angry, you're going to have a lot of extra baggage attached to anger than just simply letting the anger be there cleanly. Boy. This is kind of fun here. You know, I'm just trying to teach you to pay attention. Really well. Too well. So we can continue with this kind of attention. Well, we have 10 minutes left. Should we end with a little sitting? So you can close your eyes. And then again, you can remember that mindfulness is simply to notice what's happening right now. What's happening for you right now? What's happening within you? Before even you turn to your breath, what's going on? Can you bring more full awareness, or can you allow what's going on to rest in a bigger awareness? What is the emotion that's most predominant for you right now? Can you allow it to be there, accept it? Can you softly, ever so softly, as a whisper in the mind, name it? And feel it in your body. Feel it fully, and as you feel it, give it its freedom to be as it wishes. And then if it feels appropriate, you can settle yourself on your breathing. Feeling the next inhalation. Feeling the next exhalation. And unless something else is really compelling, let everything else settle back into the background and let yourself rest fully in the breath's experience of itself, the body's experience of breathing. Something closely related to commentary is the relationship we have towards what's going on. Notice when you're caught up by the relationship more than the actual experience. Your relationship to breathing, your ideas and feelings about it, your relationship to your physical experience, the relationship you have to your emotions. The resistance, or the justification, or the indulging. There's no need to get rid of anything. But when you notice that there's a distinction between the relationship and your direct experience, if it's easy, rest yourself in the actual experience. Well, a couple of things to end with. One is, as the instructions kind of builds over the weeks, it can sound like it's complicated to pay attention to all these things. The idea is to keep it really simple. And the teachings about the foreground and the background was intended to kind of indicate it's supposed to be simple. You very simply allow the attention to be open, to feel the breath as best you can, until something else comes by itself into the foreground. And when it comes by itself into the foreground, kind of knocking, then we let go of the breath and let our attention go there. So you don't have to kind of go looking and wondering and guessing what's there. You just kind of be at ease and allow things to come to you and bring your attention to it. I apologize if it seemed like I was being critical of psychoanalysis or psychotherapy. I think that they're extremely useful and have a very important place in our culture. I often recommend people to do psychotherapy. I don't think that mindfulness practice is necessarily the answer to all of human beings' problems. But it's very, very powerful. And the power of direct attention has often been overlooked in traditional forms of psychotherapy. And it's extremely powerful to do what we're doing here. And I brought with me a whole bunch of copies of this newsletter. This is the Spirit Rock newsletter. I'm a teacher from Spirit Rock, and our sitting group here is affiliated with Spirit Rock. Spirit Rock's kind of like the, I don't know what, but it's the main, kind of the headquarters of, in a way, informal headquarters of the Vipassana community here in California. You might want to go up there someday. They have wonderful retreats up there. Anyway, they just came out with a new newsletter, and in here you'll find interesting articles, and you'll find a list of a schedule of different kinds of retreats and activities that are offered around the Bay Area. So you can go out and get that. Also out there is a little pamphlet of the meditation instructions that by Joseph Goldstein. And if I'm too confusing, you can get the bare bones instructions from Joseph in that pamphlet out there. And the last thing, what? Donna. So the last thing then would be, especially since some of you might not have been here the first week, that this kind of class is offered on a donation basis, because it's for various reasons, but it's offered on a donation basis. We have good reasons for it. And there's two baskets out there. One basket is for rent, and we have to pay the friends rent for this building, for the use of it. And if everybody paid $1, it'd be plenty for what we have to pay for our rent and a few other things we pay for, expenses we have. But we all need to contribute in order to make it kind of possible to be here. And then the other basket is a teacher donation, and if you want to make a donation for my teaching, you can do that. 95% or more of my livelihood comes actually from the kind of donations I get from when I teach, and I put out a basket, and that's how I make a living. That's how I'm supported. So if you want to, you can do that also there. So I thank you, and next week we'll do thoughts.